Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, could President Donald Trump be in violation of the Constitution? Does he need to divest himself of his business holdings in order to keep from violating constitutional rules meant to guard against corruption? Prominent constitutional scholars, Supreme Court litigators, and former White House ethics lawyers, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, filed a lawsuit yesterday morning in a federal court in New York alleging that President Trump is violating the Constitution by allowing his hotels and other business operations to accept payments from foreign governments. The legal team filing the lawsuit will include one of our guests this hour. Actually, we're going to have three guests, so we'll move along pretty quickly here. Get your phone calls in early at 800-486-8655. We start with Professor Richard Painter, who's a law professor at the University of Minnesota. He was associate counsel to the president in the White House counsel's office from 2005 to 2007, serving as the chief ethics lawyer for President George W. Bush, White House employees, and senior nominees to Senate-confirmed positions in the executive branch. He is the author of Getting the Government America Deserves, How Ethics Reform Can Make a Difference. He contributes regularly. As a matter of fact, he's become a bit of a television star over the last few weeks on CNN, particularly, where he's been commenting on many issues, this one foremost that we're talking about this hour. Professor Richard Painter, thank you ever so much for being with us. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Yesterday on CNN, you talked about the fact that you are conservative, that you want small government, limited government. You also said this is a critically important issue, this issue of Donald Trump's possible violation of the Constitution. It's critical for the American people. President is elected to comply with the Constitution. Why is it so critical?
Well, let's talk about what the Emoluments Clause is. The founders did not want people who held positions of trust with the United States government to be taking money from foreign governments, whether through salary or business deals. We go back to the Tea Party and ask, well, what's the point of throwing all of the tea into Boston Harbor and having a war with King George, drafting the Constitution, if you're going to have the first president of the United States buying and selling tea with King George? Furthermore, the founders were well aware of the practice over in Europe. The French, in particular, were trying to buy off members of the British Parliament through various side deals, the French government. The other powerful countries in Europe were Austria, Hungary, and Russia. We seem to have heard a lot from Russia recently. But back then, the founders were very worried about kings and czars and foreign governments trying to influence the United States. So it's a categorical prohibition on any person holding a position of trust with the United States government receiving money from foreign governments and through business dealings with foreign governments, benefits from foreign governments. So we look at the Trump business empire, and we have, of course, the hotels where foreign diplomats have been rushing to stay ever since Election Day, and foreign governments are holding parties in the ballrooms and spending a lot of money on that. But even more significant is the unknown extent of foreign government financing of the Trump business empire. The debt owed by the Trump business empire is not disclosed unless President Trump himself personally owes it, and most of the debt is at the corporate level. And some of it may very well be from U.S. banks or private banks, such as Deutsche Bank, we know about. But we also know that the Bank of China is extending credit to the Trump business empire, and that is controlled by the Chinese government. That's all. All of this foreign government money has been in violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution since last Friday when he became president. Now, emolument, that term is not used as much anymore. It comes from a Latin word, emolumentum, but it refers to benefits from dealings with foreign governments. Maybe a more modern word is payola, but we do not allow it for anyone holding a position of trust with the U.S. government. And so we've asked the judge to take a look at this, find out what President Trump is receiving from foreign governments, companies controlled by foreign governments, tell him what he can have and what he can't have, so we can clarify this now rather than having to wait around and have it get tied up in a very politicized process in the House of Representatives called impeachment. We certainly do not want to go that route.
So this would mean, if this went through, that they would be taking a look at his tax returns? You couldn't do that, all of this, without looking at those, could you?
Well, I think that the judge would probably want to look at the tax returns and other business records to discern where foreign government money is coming in, and particularly sovereign wealth funds often invest side by side with American companies and ventures around the world, and those sovereign wealth fund investments might very well be emoluments, benefits in violation of the Constitution. So the first step would be for the judge to look at the whole picture, get the facts, and then tell the president what he can have and what he can't have.
Mm-hmm.
Or the judge could do it the other way around and say, okay, here are the general guidelines, so what's an emolument, what's not, and then we're going to start to have the discovery and find out what the president's bringing in and what he can have.
There's some confusion. I don't fully understand this as to whether or not you have standing, you and all the other ethics people involved in this have standing before the court. Do you think the judge will hear this case? And what is the standing issue?
Yeah, I think the judge will hear the case. But the standing issue is that the federal courts will not hear a case from anybody who says, well, gee, I think the president's violating the Constitution. I think this government agency is interpreting this regulation the wrong way. I mean, you'd have hundreds of lawsuits, if not thousands, from people who disagree with environmental regulations and this, that, and the other thing. And so they need some sort of rational way to winnow down, you know, the number of complaints and who can bring a suit and who can't. But we believe that our group, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, has demonstrated harm to our mission and our organization, because our whole focus is preventing corruption in government. This group spent a lot of time looking at the revolving door in and out of government, campaign finance and lobbying and all of that. And we've been diverted from a lot of that to this problem under the emoluments, the payments to the President of the United States himself, that we believe have pose a serious threat of corruption. For example, he's going to negotiate trade agreements, apparently with each individual country that was part of the Trans-Pacific trade deal that he's now going to back out of. Well, we have no idea whether he's getting payments from the foreign governments. They're on the other side of the negotiating table. We negotiate these trade agreements directly with foreign governments. We simply can't have our president receiving those types of payments. So our group has to focus on this, to divert a lot of resources toward it, including the cost of this litigation, and we feel that's demonstrable harm to us that's unique, in addition, of course, to the harm to the American people from this. And the judge ought to hear the case. And as I say, I think there's a much more effective way to deal with it than just waiting around for the political process to take shape, because that could be very unpredictable.
Yesterday, as you probably know, I'm sure you know, Professor Painter, NPR reported it had received a document showing that Eric Trump has replaced his father as president of Trump International Hotels Management. CNN obtained a letter signed by the president saying, Donald J. Trump, hereby resign from each and every office and position I hold. Isn't that enough?
No. If he owns the business, the benefits go to him. Doesn't matter who's managing the business any more than it matters who the hotel clerk is at the front desk. If he owns the business, the benefits go to him. If he owns a building overseas and there is a sovereign wealth fund investment or debt side by side with Trump money, that could very well be an unconstitutional payment to him.
So what does he need to do to ease any kind of corruption? Divest of everything?
I think he needs to divest of a lot of it, at least the companies doing business with foreign governments, or give it to his children. He could do that. That at least solves the constitutional problem. But the difficulty there is he would have to pay a gift tax, and I don't think he likes paying taxes. The gift tax is in lieu of the estate tax, which you eventually pay when your children inherit from you. But, of course, they may be thinking about abolishing the estate tax, so he doesn't want to pay the gift tax right now. So there may be various disadvantages to some of the plans that I've advanced for him. But he needs to focus on being president. This is a valuable Trump business empire, yes, but it's still probably worth less than what the U.S. government spends in a single day. He wanted this job. And he's got to do it in accordance with the Constitution.
What was in all those manila envelopes he presented at his press conference in January?
I have no idea what was in them. He wouldn't let the reporters take a look. So they could have been stuffed with very important legal documents. They could have had toilet paper in them or Hillary's email. I don't know what was in them, and it was meaningless.
Tim on Facebook writes, fair or not, he must liquidate his businesses. It's the price you pay to become president. If he didn't want to sell his assets, he shouldn't have run for office. It's called ethical, unbiased, uncorrupted government. I would assume you'd agree with that.
Yeah.
Let's go to a couple of phone calls. I know you have to teach soon. We have three guests with us this hour to talk about this important issue. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we start, Professor, with Lee in Williams Bay. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. I believe impeachment proceedings should proceed against Donald John Trump unless he discloses his tax returns and creates a completely blind trust for all of his holdings.
Professor Painter.
Well, I certainly think he should divest his holdings and turn everything over to a blind trustee. That is going to be the way to avoid not only the Monuments Clause problem, but other problems down the road. And there are a lot of problems that are going to come up if he continues to own these businesses. I would not recommend that the House start thinking about impeaching a president until they have clear evidence that justifies it. We went through that in 1998 with impeached a president for, yes, lying under oath. It was a lie about his sex life. But I think it was quite clear that the public did not support that. The Senate did not convict President Clinton, and the Republicans got creamed in the elections as a result. So I think that the House of Representatives certainly should investigate right now and find out what's going on. They should start hearings and ask the president what he's receiving from foreign governments and what he's not. And then let's see where things go. I think that for people to pull the impeachment lever too soon with a president is politically can backfire, and I would not recommend that.
Who knows whether polls are accurate or not? We just don't know these days. But according to a Bloomberg poll, the public doesn't really support giving up his businesses. So if you don't have overwhelming public support, maybe that you think that poll is not quite accurate. What's going to make the House decide to begin any kind of investigation?
Well, I don't think the public supports the conflicts of interest either. So the question is, what's going to happen when we have concrete conflicts of interest? We have concerns about whether there are payments coming in from foreign governments while we're negotiating trade deals with those foreign governments. We have the president's name up on a building overseas, and some terrorist or some other whack job goes and takes a shot at it. And that's careless in and of itself, having the president's name, our president's name, up in a building in some of these countries overseas. So there are going to be scandals, bribery, gratuity scandals. When the scandals arise because of the businesses, the public's going to start asking him the question of, well, didn't you anticipate this? Weren't you warned about it? Why didn't you sell it?
And when will you know, Professor, whether or not the lawsuit's going to proceed?
That's up to the judge to decide. The judge fixes the schedule and makes the decision.
All right. Carry on with all your TV work, too. You're doing a great job, sir.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Professor Richard Painter, he has literally been all over CNN. I watch a lot of networks, but he's been all over CNN recently. He's a law professor at the University of Minnesota, and he served in the President George W. Bush White House from 2005 to 2007, associate counsel to the president in the White House counsel's office, serving as the chief ethics lawyer for the president. He is one of the parties to the suit that was filed in New York federal court yesterday. And along with a number of other ethics professors and lawyers from all over the country, looking at this whole issue as to whether or not the president is in violation of the Constitution, the Emoluments Clause, for not completely divesting of his holdings. And we're going to continue the conversation with two other guests. Our last guest will say there is no need for him to divest. He will explain his position, and we'll continue in just a moment here with Jay Wexler, a law professor at Boston University, and we'll take many more of your phone calls. Please stay on hold. All your calls will be applicable for the whole hour. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network. Professor Jay Wexler joins us now, law professor at Boston University. He's been published in all kinds of scholarly journals and news outlets, author of five books, including The Odd Clauses, Understanding the Constitution through 10 of its Most Curious Provisions. I think we'll have to talk with him about that down the road. He published a study of humor in Supreme Court oral arguments in the legal journal The Green Bag, and he has worked as a law clerk for a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and also for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the U.S. Supreme Court. Our number is 800-486-8655. He'll be with us for a longer period of time so we can take phone calls for him. Professor Wexler, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
In some recent piece in the Times or the Post, you have said there's enormous potential for foreign influence over national policy because the president has not divested. It's something we've always guarded against over the nation's 240-year history. Give us an idea of what you mean by that. What kind of foreign influence?
Well, what I mean by that is he's got businesses. The president has businesses all over the world, in you know, country after country. And of course, a giant business that foreign governments take advantage of in the United States as well. And what my thinking is that if a foreign government chooses for a Trump good or service in a competitive market over competitors because they believe that it will make Trump, you know, it'll curry favor with Trump. That's exactly what we don't want. So here, my simplest example is this: imagine you have the Chinese state government wants to hold a big dinner, and they want to have some sparkling wine at the dinner, and you know, there's 1,000 wines they can choose from, and they decide to go with the Trump sparkling Blanc de Blanc, which I looked up today, costs $34 a bottle, and apparently has a pear on the nose or something like that. So there are thousands of wines they can choose from. They choose to buy 1,000 bottles of the Trump 2010 Blanc de Blanc because they want to curry favor with them. I mean, certainly he's somebody who looks at small things. You know, imagine if they didn't pick the wine, what he would have tweeted. So, you know, so they pay market value. You know, there's this argument out there that if a foreign state pays market value for a good, it's not an emolument or a present. I don't think that's the point. I think the point is that because he has all these businesses all over the world and goods and services that he offers to the public, a foreign government might choose his stuff over other people's stuff, even though the other people's stuff might be better, because they want to curry favor with him. And as a result, we don't know if he will then curry favor, you know, he will reward them by doing something nice for them on the policy front. And that's the key that I think is the problem. I actually think it's a present. I'm starting to think that it's not, you know, emoluments is a weird word.
Yeah, it is.
And nobody knows what it means, but it's sort of a present, I think, if the Chinese government decides to use his wine over, you know, a nice sense there.
Right. So tell me if this thing, because this kind of struck me when I read all of his foreign involvements today. I don't know if this is covered under the emoluments or not, but it seems like there could be a conflict here. He has 8 registered companies in Saudi Arabia. At a rally in Alabama last year, he said, "Saudi Arabia, I get along with all of them. They buy apartments from me. They spend $40 million, $50 million. Am I supposed to dislike them? I like them very much." Is that covered under the emoluments, or is that, what is that? Because it seems strange.
Well, it certainly gets to exactly the problem that, you know, we want the president to be making policy based on what's right for the public interest, not because he likes certain people because they favor his businesses. I mean, and so whether you consider that a conflict of interest problem or an ethics problem or an actual violation of the emoluments clause, you know, I would tend – it's a hard question. I think the constitutional issue is a difficult one. I think there's a plausible argument that all of these businesses violate the emoluments or presence clause for exactly the kind of reason that you just discussed. But whatever it is, it's a problem, I think.
Our guest in the previous 20 minutes, Professor Painter, has said that the potential violations are so serious it risks eventual impeachment unless he, at a minimum, transfers ownership to his kids or another party. Do you agree with that?
Well, that's so that question is basically an evaluate, a sort of a prediction of what the House of Representatives might do, which is itself a prediction of what the American people will think of what he's doing. And I don't know if I right now it doesn't seem like there's a big surge for impeachment under the Emoluments Clause or anything else.
Right.
I could imagine, you know, a situation arises where it becomes clear that he's chosen to favor a particular foreign state because they favored him in some business transaction, in which case, you know, depending on how it's covered and what the specifics are, we might start seeing public interest, the public's, you know, opinion changing. And if that happens enough, it could turn into an impeachment, a demand for an impeachment. But I don't know. I mean, if there's one thing we learned from the election, it's that it's pretty hard to predict what's going to happen. So I'm pretty wary of trying to guess what's going to happen. But I think impeachment is the one thing, the one remedy that the people have here in this situation.
And in order to avoid that entirely, Professor Wexler, what would President Trump have to do?
Well, I think he just has to, he has to divest in the business. I don't I'm no corporate law expert, but what he can't be doing is he cannot be personally benefiting either now or, you know, in the future from decisions that foreign countries are making now. So, I mean, if the kids are running the business, that doesn't matter because the money still goes to him, and he'll have been, when he gets out of office, mm-hmm. his business will be that much bigger, and of course he knows that now, so that risks the same kind of corruption as anything else. So it has to be some situation where he just does not stand to financially gain from any foreign decision to use these things that are now at least called Trump Towers, wine, steak, et cetera, et cetera.
And why were the founders so intent on putting an emoluments clause in the Constitution?
I think there are a lot of different parts of the Constitution which are aimed at getting rid of corruption. They were really, you know, they came from England. They saw a corrupt king. They were fleeing from him. They revolted against him. And they were very concerned with making sure that those problems were not repeated in the new nation. And so they were very strong. They wrote very strong provisions to make sure that there was not even the slightest perception of corruption. What's interesting about this emoluments clause, I'm going to say president's clause because I keep wanting
thank you. I know it's hard, but once you learn it, you remember it. So we've all learned it.
I guess that's right. And it is fun to say emoluments.
It is. If you feel, emoluments.
But, you know, if you read that clause, it says it has two anys and a whatever in it. It says, so it doesn't just say the president, you know, an officer can't accept a present. It says an officer can not accept any present or emolument of any kind, whatever. I mean, that's pretty striking. If you read the Constitution, you don't see that very often. Whatever. That's a pretty bizarre word to have in the Constitution. It's like a double exclamation marker, you know, bold. And I think that was on purpose. They really wanted to make sure that even the slightest bit of corruption was excised from the new republic.
Hmm. Sounds like you make constitutional law a lot of fun for your students, Professor.
Oh, thanks. That's nice of you. There's no reason for it not to be fun, you know?
It's a
fun
interesting
topic.
Yeah. Well, we have a ton of phone calls coming in, so let's start taking them. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Jay Wexler is a law professor at Boston University, and he is the author of 5 books, including The Odd Clauses, Understanding the Constitution Through 10 of Its Most Curious Provisions. He has published a study of humor in Supreme Court oral arguments. He has worked as a law clerk for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the U.S. Supreme Court, and he's our guest for a while here. Let's go to Suzanne in Lake Geneva. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really just wanted to say thank you to Crewe for filing this lawsuit on behalf of the people of the United States. I do think there's a serious conflict of interest, and I appreciate them filing the lawsuit so that they will be able to get to the bottom of his business interests, see his actual taxes, the courts will, and find out, you know, what debt he has and find out what conflict of interest are actually there. And that's really all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Suzanne. Professor Wexler.
I agree. I'm glad that they brought the lawsuit. Also, I was just reading the complaint earlier today, and it's very detailed about the specific interest that the president has in all of these different countries, from Turkey to Scotland to Indonesia. And I think it's important to get the details and the specifics so that we can evaluate, so the people can evaluate whether they think the president is acting appropriately, whether it be under the Constitution or otherwise. And so a lawsuit might be the right vehicle for doing that. We might find out things through discovery. It's certainly going to keep the issue on the front page, or near the front page, I guess, of the papers. And so I think it's I agree with the caller that I'm glad that they brought the lawsuit as well.
And when you look at the people bringing this, prominent constitutional scholars, Supreme Court litigators, and former White House ethics lawyers bringing the lawsuit, do they have, there's been a lot of press about whether or not they have standing, and many people saying this isn't going anywhere. Is it, do you think? Do they have standing?
Well, I think the standing is a hard claim. I think I would be very surprised if a court decides to actually reach the merits of the case, either because they find that Crewe doesn't have standing, the plaintiffs don't have standing, or because they just believe it's a political question, which is a doctrine that courts sometimes use just to stay out of these big issues that they believe are best handled by the political branches and the people. I could always be surprised, but I think it's a pretty hard argument to make that they have standing in the case. So, but that doesn't mean that that the lawsuit shouldn't have been brought. I think that the claims on the merits are strong, certainly reasonable, and I think that through the process of litigating the case, we could learn quite a few important facts about what's going on out there.
We go next to Jim in Spooner. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I am a Trump supporter, but I do understand everybody's concern. Like your previous guest stated, you know, if he just gives the business to his children, everybody's happy, he's out of it. But my concern, or not my concern, my point would be, if people don't see the big picture, you would say behind closed doors, okay, you know, make all the money you can, in the 4 to 8 years, you give it back to me. So he's still profiting, you know, from his business. So to me, it just seems pointless, unless I'm wrong. I don't, you know, that's my take on it.
Professor, go ahead.
So if I understand the question, you're saying you don't understand why it would solve the problem to give the business to his sons for the 4 to 8 years. If that's your point, I agree. Because he knows that he'll get the business back in 4 to 8 years, and it will have benefited from whatever deals are made in the interim. The fact that he doesn't currently run it, I don't think that matters, because you still have the same potential. He could say, that China didn't accept my wine or didn't buy my wine, and so I'm mad at China, even though, you know, the loss I'm not going to realize until I get out of office. You know, that's a small example, but if you can multiply it 1,000 times, and you can understand why it might be a problem. So I don't think that that's a solution. I don't think that the giving it to the sons for a while is a solution, if I understand it correctly.
Did we get you correctly, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, basically, but yes and no. I mean, if he gives this to his children, the business, 100%, he's out of it. He basically sells it to them. And then he comes back in 48 years and says, okay, I'm going to buy it back. I mean, he's still gaining on everything, like he still owned it.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, I guess there could be variations. If he really gets rid of it, and then, but he knows he's going to buy it back, or he has a good idea that he's going to buy it back, and that's sort of, it's clear that that's the arrangement, then I think the giving it to the sons is kind of just a formal rather than a substantive change. I'm not even sure that giving it to his sons, even if it was completely given it to his sons and he didn't get it back, I don't know if that solves the problem either. I'm trying to – I mean, maybe it does, but I'm trying to think of, like, instances in the past where presidents have refused to take gifts from foreign states, like Martin Van Buren refused to take a couple of horses and some rose water from an imam and it, without congressional approval. And I'm just wondering, what if he took them and just gave those horses to his kids? Would that have solved the problem? I don't know. I mean, family, pretty close. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question, but mm-hmm. I don't know the answer.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I know this doesn't really fall under any monuments, but my concern is it has these physical holdings around the world, like you said, in Turkey. What if, like, ISIS decides to blow up his hotel in Turkey? How is he going to respond? Is he going to declare war on Turkey, bring the United States into war in a foreign country because one of his hotels got blown up?
And wasn't Professor Painter mention
yes,
sort of
did.
Something like that?
Yes.
And yeah, you're right. I don't that itself is not necessarily a emoluments problem, although it kind of points out why you might think having these things over there is an emoluments problem. But it's just a general worry that I agree. And if that happens, I hope the American people hold him responsible for that. We don't want our president starting wars over his or her personal businesses.
Mm-hmm. The person who will come on after you has said a couple things in favor of letting things be as they are, and let me see how you respond to this. If you put everything into a blind trust, David Rifkin says that such a trust would not eliminate the virtual certainty that actions Trump takes as a president would affect his personal wealth for good or ill, and the step is not required by law.
Well, I guess it depends on why he thinks it's not required by law. I think if we're talking about the emoluments clause, there are a lot of issues there. But for the reason that I've explained before, I think he not only has to put it in a blind trust, he has to get rid of it completely. And it's not required by a statute, for example. The Constitution is much more vague than your typical statute, and we've never quite dealt with this kind of problem before, so we don't know for sure what the remedy would be. But I think if you look at the Constitution and you look at the problems that these business interests pose, I think there's a good argument that he should do more than put it in a private trust, or blind trust, rather.
Jackie, thank you. Let's go to Raymond in Richmond. Hi, Raymond.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm looking at something a little further about indirect benefits. With this cabinet of billionaires, and especially now this new Secretary of State, who has all this oil involvement with Russia, and now Trump is already coming out saying that Russia cooperates with us on ISIS, which to me is like just a smokescreen. And if he will reduce or take off some of Obama's,
executive orders.
Yeah, I'm missing the word there. But if his cronies benefit from this, isn't that part of it too?
Does the emolument clause affect to other people in the cabinet or in government, Professor?
Well, the emoluments clause would apply to other officers, but I don't think any of those officers have current business holdings like Trump does. Now, it's kind of a classic problem in American government that the people who run agencies tend to be very much linked to the industries that they're regulating or that they're representing, which kind of makes sense because people who run a private the head of a telecommunications company is going to be somebody who really knows about communications, and so that person might end up being the head of the chairman of the FCC, that sort of thing. And so sometimes people say that that system is a sort of a loaded system in which industries, you know, benefits from having leaders who come from industry. But I think that's a different kind of argument than the Trump actually continues to have business dealings in all of these places and can directly financially benefit from them. So it wouldn't be an emoluments problem, but it's just sort of a more general problem in U.S. government.
Do you think even if the court doesn't take up this issue, that there will be enough pressure on the president to release his tax returns, which would clear up some of this? Do you think he will do that?
My guess is no. I don't see any indication or anything that makes me think he will ever do that. But I'm a very bad predictor.
Well, we want to have you on again to talk about the odd clauses, understanding the Constitution through 10 of its most curious provisions. It would be a fun show. So just be warned,
absolutely.
You'll get a
Anytime.
Phone call. Great. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Professor Jay Wexler, law professor at Boston University. We continue our conversation. David Rivkin will be joining us momentarily. And he says that suggestions that Trump put his business holdings in a blind trust to avoid potential conflicts of interest are unrealistic, and they're also unfair. So we'll speak with him in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Joining us now is David Rivkin. He practices appellate and constitutional law for the firm Baker Hostetler. He has served in the Justice Department under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, also served in the White House Counsel's Office in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, and has written for many news publications. And David, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Suggestions that Donald Trump put his business holdings in a blind trust, unrealistic and unfair. Why are they unfair?
Well, they're unfair because since he has substantial, let's call them business assets, the only way he can put them in, quote, blind trust, by the way, for purposes of your listeners, the way blind trust entails an arrangement where you basically take your existing stock portfolio of liquid assets, treasuries, and you give it to a bank that would appoint a trustee, and the trustee basically is going to reshuffle that portfolio. So the idea being you do not know which stocks you hold. Obviously, you cannot put operating companies or partnerships in blind trusts. So the only way President Trump could do that would be to, in fact, divest himself of all those holdings. A lot of them are not liquid. A lot of them, of course, are co-owned with his children and various other individuals. In fact, I'll tell you a couple of things. First of all, contrary to this notion that all presidents put their assets in blind trust, no, that is not true. The only presidents, and it's a fairly recent practice, who put their assets in blind trust are those who do have, as I mentioned, stock and various debt obligations. No president in American history who held business assets, and been at least five, including most recent. I'm not going to go into, you know, Jefferson, Madison, and Washington that had extensive plantations, but LBJ certainly did not divest himself of his media properties, and Jimmy Carter certainly did not divest himself of his peanut farm. They were managed by different people while in office.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump would be the first president who would be asked to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And just two related points. First of all, for him to actually sell those assets would involve, for him and his lawyers, not months, but years of extensive negotiations with lots of banks and a lot of other entities, which create its own problems. So this is not something he's legally required to do. This is something that would create tremendous headache and be very costly. And more importantly than that, it would serve as a deterrent to an entrepreneur president, because basically the people who would not face these headaches are investor types like Warren Buffett or members of a political class. Now you ask yourself, what is one of the key themes from this election? People sick and tired. American people are sick and tired of members of a political class or even investor class getting into office. So what entrepreneur, a person who creates a business, puts his heart into this, is going to be interested in selling this? Do you think Henry Ford would have been interested in selling his company as he was building it up, or Rockefeller, or J.P. Morgan? I mean, yes, years and years and years and decades down the road, you know, you turn to philanthropy, you do it in your own time. So this whole thing makes no sense.
What could he do? Because there will be questions about potential conflicts of interest, considering the countries where he does have business interests and his name on hotels. You know, he's now the president. What is it that he could do to keep his holdings and to, as you say, adopt a reasonable system to avoid conflicts and reassure the American people that the administration is acting ethically?
Well, I think he's done exactly what he could do. Didn't have to do, by the way. He basically separated himself from operational management of OSA assets exactly the way LBJ did, exactly the way Jimmy Carter did. He entrusted that to his children. He indicated that he would not receive any information about what business operations they pursue. He also indicated, again, not because he had to, that they will curtail engaging in any new foreign deals. I think he's done a plenty.
Mm-hmm. But how do
and
we...
I don't, I, yeah.
No, go ahead.
No, I mean, the setup they announced is going to involve, again, him stepping out of any operational involvement. They're also going to have an ethics person who oversees this whole arrangement. I mean, that's how we would know. Again, I think one can have, you know, confidence in this arrangement.
And yet, he had that press conference January 11, I believe, where he brought a huge stack of manila folders. He said they contained documents that would transfer complete and total control of his companies to his sons and to a longtime business associate, but nobody's seen the documents.
Well, again, look, it is not common to see documents that memorialize these types of arrangements. I mean, I'm inclined to take any person, including the president or any president, at his or her word. I mean, why are we going to assume? I mean, look, enough people are involved in this arrangement that if somehow what is being done is less than has been publicly articulated, in this day and age, would inevitably leak to folks in the media, perhaps folks like you, or in the print media, or TV media, and a huge political price is going to be paid for it. I don't think that it's essential that, you know, a 100-page legal document transferring operational control and various other things need to be read. Need to be made public.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about a firewall between himself and his adult children with respect to family business affairs, it would give him no information about their business dealings. He would pledge not to discuss the dealings with him. Is there a way, for people who are concerned about this, and granted, I don't think a huge number of Americans have seen this as a top priority issue, but should they, and should those who are now concerned about it want some reassurance, what kind of reassurance would he have to give us? I mean, did you take somebody's word for this, that they're not going to talk about business dealings, so there wouldn't be an apparent conflict of interest? How do you know?
Well, again, this is how do you prove a negative. Whenever you create, you know, firewalls like this, you rely on the integrity of the people involved. I repeat, there will be a price to be paid if those commitments were violated, and I see no basis not to accept them at face value, unless subsequent events prove otherwise. But I mean, again, how do you prove a negative? It is quite common. It certainly happens a lot of times in the private sector world where you create these types of firewalls to deal with various issues, and they're presumed, unless evidence emerges to a contrary, they're presumed to be obeyed. I mean, we are, you know, a rule-compliant society. And as I said, another thing is there would be lots of people involved here. And I think everybody's going to play by the rules. And again, none of it is necessary. This was done in order to assuage concerns. He could have just left things the way they were.
Let's go to phone calls for you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. David Rifkin is with us. He served in the Justice Department under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, also in the White House Counsel's Office in the Herbert Walker Bush administration. He practices appellate and constitutional law in the district. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. We go to Abraham in Lake Geneva, first caller for you. Hi, Abraham.
Hi. I actually would like to respond to something your guest, to a statement your guest just made regarding the current president and the fact that, I mean, I think he said that we should take him at his word. It's clearly been pointed out on numerous occasions, many times over the weekend, where the president-elect has, or President Trump has outright lied to the American people. So, with someone that so easily lies to the American people, I mean, I see how it's really difficult to take this president at his word. And in addition, I don't think that your guest has actually explained clearly the emollient clause. And from what I understand, the President Trump has not met the expectations laid out in the emollient clause by handing over his company to his children.
Okay, thanks, Abraham.
Well, two things. First of all, again, I disagree with characterization by President lying. I mean, I know people disagree about things like the size of a crowd or whatnot, but I mean, look, we're talking about a different issue here. We're talking about the arrangement that has been memorialized that involves lots of lawyers, lots of compliance people, and a number of other individuals. These things tend to work precisely because if they're not operating as planned, somebody is going to talk about it and a huge political price will be paid. So I would urge your listener to rely on the president's self-interest here. As to the Emoluments Clause, I'm very happy to talk about it. You just haven't asked me that question. Emoluments Clause is not a problem here at all. It is irrelevant. It does not apply here at all for a couple of very fundamental reasons. One, if you look at the language of Emolument Clause, which is Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8, it talks about applies in a situation where a person holding, and I'm slightly paraphrasing, an office of profit or trust under the United States accepts a present, comma, emolument, comma, office, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, from any king, foreign prince, and potentate. Okay. Mr. Trump is a person holding an office, a President Trump, of profit and trust under the United States. To best of my knowledge, President Trump or Mr. Trump is not receiving a penny from any foreign entity. The entities that receive payments for various services, like hotel services, et cetera, are corporations and partnership, of which he's a shareholder or a partner in case of partnerships. They're not the same person. Okay, it's absolutely clearly established, black-letter law, that all those other entities have their separate identity, have separate personhood for legal purposes. So it does not apply to Mr. Trump at all by its language. Okay, and the second point is that emoluments, the word emolument, while broad, does not describe every pavement. If that was otherwise, the word present would be superfluous. Emolument, as I was understood in the 18th century, describes a payment you receive for something you do in office. So leaving aside my first, even taking off the table my first argument, if what is happening here is a hotel room is being rented for fair market value, or office space is being rented for fair market value, is not an emolument. And that, by the way, isn't just my view. That is the view of Office of Legal Counsel that addressed this issue in various contexts, on innumerable occasions. I mean, if I have time, I can elaborate.
We only have about a minute left.
Well, very, very briefly, this issue was addressed in the context of a different emoluments clause, but it's parallel to this, a so-called, you know, presidential compensation emoluments clause, to see if President Reagan, who used to be the governor of California, could continue to receive payments from that state. And OLC said very clearly, yes, he can, because those payments from the state of California have nothing to do with what he is doing in office. They're entirely unrelated. And there are lots of other OLC opinions, and OLC really is the guardian, if you will, of the heart of a executive, the guardian of internal disposition of constitutional and statutory issues. The whole emoluments clause argument is absurd, frankly. It's a bad joke, except it's not funny.
Do you think it's going to go through in the courts or not? Do you think they'll dismiss it?
No. Merits aside, nobody is standing. to vindicate this claim? Nobody, because nobody has been injured with sufficient degree of specificity and particularity that is required to have a standing in our constitutional system. We do not have what is known as taxpayer standing, okay? You can't just say, well, this constitutional provision was violated, I don't like it, therefore I'm going to go sue. Nobody has been injured by this, so nobody has standing.
What about other businesses who may be joining the suit? Unfair competition.
How is it unfair competition? How are you injured by the fact that somebody else is receiving a payment for services? That dog would not hunt at all. I mean, it would never, ever get to the resolution of a merits. But if it did...
Okay. Thank you, David. Thank you, David, very much. Yeah, great to talk to you. David Rivkin practices appellate and constitutional law. He was in the White House counsel's office in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration and also served under President Ronald Reagan. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting hour and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios. News is coming up, and we'll talk about isolation.